today. Thanks for tuning in. We've got a couple of things we want to go over. One is from our Instagram comments on our story yesterday, which is coffee beers and how to coffee them. We also wanted to talk about milkshake style IPAs, a subset of hazies, and finally go over some spring beer styles. And then if we have time, we'll do some troubleshooting tips for you as well.
And that's kind of what we got planned out for you.
Heck yeah. So coffee beers are a beer style that we do a lot. We have probably our flagship beer, our most famous beer that we do is a coffee-style Kolsch, which will brew a nice meaty Kolsch base and then infuse it with different flavors of coffee. And my wife says very purple. I'm aware it's purple. I don't know what happened. It's something in OBS, and I can't seem to fix it. But if anyone has an idea, let me know. So we have a very unique method of coffeeing beer, but there are a few other methods that other people will use. So we'll kind of go over those and talk, one by one about what those are.
Should we go over the first one?
Yes.
So most of the time people put coffee like as a whirlpool addition in beer, and honestly that's not what we're gonna usually recommend. That's gonna have a really, really high extract yield from the coffee, but also can pull a lot of those astringent sort of tannic flavors that I personally can't stand about coffee.
So if you ever had coffee beers that kind of seem like they're too noted, or they have flavors going in two different directions. You have that kind of beer flavor and then that coffee flavor, and they seem disjointed. A lot of times this comes from using coffee like in the whirlpool or something that's a little bit too hot, where you're really pulling a lot of that coffee flavor.
So the other option, which is the one that we recommend, is adding coffee as sort of a secondary, or when we'll actually add it is in our bright tank itself.
This is a whole bean process, and so what we use this for is the oils basically on the coffee beans will extract to the outside, and we're using alcohol. This is why we do it in the secondary, because the beer has already made some alcohol, but we're using that alcohol as a solvent for those oils.
That's going to pull out it all depends. So that's going to pull out flavors in a different way. It's going to pull them out slower, and you're going to get different flavors during different times. We personally will like to let it only sit for 12 to maybe 24 hours at the most on the coffee beans. That is going to pull out sort of the smoothest flavors and all of those aromatics that you're really looking for. If you start going kind of that 24 to 36 hour range, you can start to get a little bit more of that raw coffee bean bite. And anything more than 36 hours, you just start getting this like really, really weird vegetal flavor that personally we like to avoid in beer, unless maybe you're doing it like with coffees and peppers. I don't know, because that's
it can get that like we call it green pepper note too, but it definitely
exactly.
Gets that kind of green pepperiness or I call it beaniness.
Yep.
You can get that, and sometimes you can get a little bit of extra unpleasant bitterness with it as well.
Yeah.
And so we like to avoid going over that 24-hour mark, and sometimes depending on how we're what size or how we're infusing the coffee, we can definitely get that full nice coffee flavor in less than that. And another added thing to this is you don't get any of that like cooked black coffee. That's that brewed coffee flavor.
Yeah. Or the color, as a matter of fact. So that's the other thing. So when you add any beans to really any secondary, you're not pulling the color out of them. That's kind of part of the thing that really blows people's mind when we do our coffee pale ales and our coffee Kolsch here, is that, that you've got a pale colored beer and yet it's got coffee in it. And so people go, this doesn't have coffee in it. And then they taste it and it's like, whoa, that does have coffee, but where's the color at?
Yeah, and that's kind of our base to any white stouts we do as well, because we'll do the same kind of technique, but with things like cocoa nibs. And we'll even use liquid oak tannin to get more oak flavor and richness without the, without the color and the extra stuff that comes with it.
Speaking of white stouts, let me like lead you into, because the other thing is you can play around, which is what we do, with all sorts of different types of coffee beans, types of roasts. For instance, with our coffee Kolsch, we use a caramel-flavored coffee bean, which is, I think it's a more mild roast too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, light roast.
Yeah, so it's a lighter roast, which kind of gives you that really, really mellow, easy flavor profile. But for a white stout, we might use something more aggressive, and you're much more familiar with the coffee.
Yeah, normally what I do is I grab a mix of some sort of flavored coffee that might have, like, for example, a chocolate-flavored coffee, as long as it's, fresh, local, it's got some nice flavors behind it. And then I'll use a high percentage of an espresso bean in there for that infusion too, because that espresso bean does have a little bit more of that aggressiveness that kind of tricks your palate into thinking you're drinking a stout, even though you've got a nice blonde beer. The last thing on coffee that I see done probably Well, I see people do brewed coffee. I'm just going to say straight up, do not use brewed coffee to infuse with beer. But I do see a lot of people use cold brewed coffee, which is a method that really decreases that astringency, that bitterness, and allows you to infuse that coffee into your beer by still, you know, still not creating too much of a disjointed flavor. But I've seen this done on a range of, with a range of success. And so what I would say the easiest, stop popping pills.
Bear with me, folks. I'm sick.
What I would say the easiest thing to do is our method that we like to do, which is infusing whole beans into secondary and only letting those go for a day. And you can do those in, you know, your primary vessel, but during secondary fermentation before you keg, if that's the one way to transfer. Or if you go from a secondary vessel into kegs, you can do it in that secondary vessel too. Just don't put it in your final vessel because that will be that will obviously allow it to get burnt and beany.
Finally, let's talk about the balance of the beer that you're adding the coffee to and the amount that you're adding. First of all, it's surprising how little coffee it takes to achieve the flavor that you're usually looking for. I know for our coffee Kolsch, we try to shoot for about 6 ounces of coffee per barrel. So when we're talking a 5-gallon batch at home, you're only putting an ounce of whole bean coffee in there, which really isn't very much at all. But it does give you a strong flavor. Also, the sort of base beer itself. We try to shoot for beers that are naturally going to be sweeter, especially if you're going on the darker side. Throwing something like Peter's Espresso Beans at a dry stout will probably just kind of double up on that naturally dry mouthfeel, that sort of bite at the end of it. So generally speaking, you're going to want to have a little bit of a sweeter base beer that you're throwing coffee at to begin with.
Short circuit brewers, by the way, if you know how to fix that purple haze in OBS, we kind of randomly got rid of it last time, and for whatever reason, it didn't go away this time, and I thought it would just naturally go away. We were wrong. So if you know how to fix that, if you've got any hints on how to get rid of that purple, let us know, because it's, and we're using OBS for streaming. But in lieu of that, let's just keep moving on. The next thing that we had we were going to talk about was basically milkshake IPAs and ways to incorporate those into your spring beers.
Milkshakes?
Yeah.
Milkshakes has been around for a couple years now, but Spokane always seems to be a little bit on the late side. Literally like last year was when Hazy's finally got big up here. No big deal.
We did have a couple people playing around with milkshakes at IPAs, and we did a couple last year too.
Yeah. But milkshakes, I think, so they're kind of this interesting hybrid. At least that's what they seem to be evolving into. And what they are is they take sort of the hopping profiles, all those late edition hops of your hazy IPAs, as well as that soft water chemistry, which is going to have really high levels of chlorides in there. So you're not going to have really any bitter bite, but also throwing a bunch of lactose at the beer, right?
Yep.
Uh-oh. But these I've seen brewed in a few ways now, though. So the one thing with that I will note about milkshake IPAs, or at least kind of what I'm seeing them turn into, is that they don't necessarily always have to be hazy. And I feel like people are finally starting to find them out to end up with a nice clear beer in the end.
Yeah. So the milkshake IPAs basically can get some of that turbidity or that same look from basically the lactose, the fact that it's a creamier beer. And then the other part of that is all the hop oils. If you blend that with the fact that you're going to be incorporating some sort of fruit, you can get a nice, beautiful beer without necessarily needing to incorporate all the same techniques you would do to get a hazy. Because sometimes, yeah, especially if you're using a powdery or yeast strain, if that yeast flavor ends up in a milkshake IPA, it can be distracting.
Yeah. I honestly think the milkshakes will be easier for a homebrewer to achieve, too. I know there's a lot of complex methodologies that'll go into a lot of, you know, doing a really, really well-designed hazy beer. And, you know, things like pressure fermentations and complete, like, loto transfers and all these other things, which are always good for any hop-forward beer. With that said, I feel like you can kind of simplify that down for doing a milkshake. You're probably on a 5-gallon batch going to be putting somewhere about a pound of lactose sugar in there. And ultimately, you're going to end up with a really, really light, easy, somewhat sweeter side, but still a hop-forward beer that's going to play really, really well with any of the New World hops that you're going to be throwing at a hazy. With that said, I think you can even reduce the hops. You probably don't have to be throwing, you know, 12 ounces or a pound of hops into a 5-gallon batch of beer for it. You could probably reduce that down to, you know, 4 to 6 ounces and be just fine.
Yeah, and I will add this, that I don't like to do a lot of upfront hopping. I'll do a small amount of upfront hopping in my milkshake IPAs, but a lot of it does go into the whirlpool or in some sort of a pressured hop back in settings/advanced. I did try that, and I didn't see anything change, but that could just be a delay on my computer. Yeah, I like to basically incorporate as much that's going to give you a ton of that flavor, but without trying to get too assertive with those milkshake-style IPAs. And sometimes we'll even partially sour them, because I think that really blends in with any sweetness that we want to add from the fruit.
Yeah, and I think the number one thing I have seen people do wrong with milkshake IPAs, at least the way I perceive the style, is that they tend to be over-bittered. That's also easy to do with a hazy again, but, yeah, it's just one of those things where, like, you do not have to have any kind of bittering addition at all. You know, these are beers that, you know, might only come in at 10 IBUs. So it's you know, a good whirlpool addition, you're probably going to get more than that off of them. So don't focus on any kind of bittering hops at all. Get those in the whirlpool, get a good dry hop in there. And let the sweetness of the lactose come through, really, is the whole point of a milkshake.
That's right. With that, you can play with some of the bitterness if you're using a less aggressive hop. So not a hop that, if you've got something like Warrior, or even if you've got a cryo hop that's, 25 IBUs, and you're really not going to get a ton of extra stuff off of just the raw bitterness, you can play around with that range. Use it as the same thing we would use an acid for, but throw in a lot of those hops on the back end. There's more that comes in with milkshake IPAs, for example, when it comes to fruiting and fruiting techniques to retain some sweetness, get some awesome colors off that. But we won't go too in-depth with that because we have a video coming out on every way to fruit a beer, so I'll make sure to mention that during that video.
Shall we go on to troubleshooting?
Let's go on to troubleshooting.
Sounds good. So we're going on troubleshooting.
If you say so. So troubleshooting is something that... we help people with a lot here in the store. People will come in and say, hey, I brewed this beer this one time and it turned out great. And then I brewed it the next time and it turned out just okay. Or this beer was different time to time. Or even something as simple for early home brewers that are like, hey, I've used this yeast on at least 3 different beers, but on this 4th beer, I used this yeast and it's a day later and it hasn't started up yet. Why is my yeast broken? And so we're going to break down kind of some ways to look at your methods, your systems, and your ingredients to make sure that your consistency is always there.
So first off, let's give you a little backstory on kind of how this idea came to be too. So we did a side-by-side recently with 2 different mash types. And as a result, we actually happened to be doing them on 2 different systems at the same time, which turns out might not have been a good idea because one of them came in at a much higher gravity than the other. And this is with the same malts, by the way. Then when they finish at the same gravity, but flavor-wise, they're completely different, which means there is several things that went weird in there. So kind of explaining how we would kind of go about breaking down to figure out what happened to make those 2 beers different, we figure it's a good way to discuss with all you out there.
And truth be told, in that particular brew day, it was during a busy day here in the store too, so the one that we were trying to do as consistently as possible, that was the kind of the variable. That one was a very haphazard brew day, which happens sometimes when you're trying to run a business and take care of all these experiments all at the same time. It's why we're leading into this. So let's start with methods, and I kind of want to start with yeast and then work backwards into the more complex stuff, because yeast, in my mind, is one of the simplest things that you can take care of to make sure that you're brewing consistent beer. And that goes into kind of 2 things. First of all is... yes, wife, that is coffee in my cup. The first thing is just making sure that you're almost always doing a starter or overpitching. Starter is going to be the number one best way to make sure you have healthy yeast going into your beer. And if you can use a starter and make sure that's done cleanly, then you're always going to get more consistent beer because the variable that you're limiting is that time frame before the yeast starts really jumping into chewing on your beer.
Yep, you got to get them through that lag phase. Even, you know, I've even done starters where I literally wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, do a starter, and by the time the beer's finished later that afternoon, evening, I've got the beer through that quote-unquote lag phase, which is just where they're kind of getting a little bit of oxygen in their system and getting ready to go, and that thing's already at a krausen, and you pitch it, and you're instantly fermenting. So that's just going to do nothing but good for your beer.
Yeah, and the another reason that this is important is because if you don't make it through that lag phase in a consistent time frame, you're basically putting variable levels of stress on your yeast, which means sometimes they're going to throw some fruity flavors at you, sometimes they're going to throw some bright tinny flavors at you, and then sometimes they'll do exactly what you want it to, which is kind of ferment perfectly neutral for that strain of yeast. And so starters, the number one thing that every home brewer can do and should do in every beer regardless. But sometimes you get lazy, and so having a good rest of your system when it comes to yeast health is also important. Things like oxygenation.
So, yeah, oxygenation is a really great way to improve your consistency, especially batch to batch, and especially if you're not doing starters. That's the beauty of a starter is it kind of alleviates that absolute necessity for oxygenation. We really prefer to use pure O2. I usually time it and go about, I think I do 45 seconds at like one, what is it? The one setting on our thing.
Flow.
Yeah. But, yeah, try to just get that consistent regardless of the method you're using. If you're shaking your carboy up, if you got a little air pump that you're pumping in, just try to do it consistently every time. Yeah, that's about it for oxygenation. So the next part about yeast is actually going to be the temperature range which you're fermenting. And really that comes down to knowing the yeast strain that you're working with, right? Because every strain is going to be a little different.
Yeah, there are a lot of strains that people have a consistent temperature that they'll ferment everything at. And so, you know, they'll get something like Flagship, or they'll get something like Cal Lager, American 2 even. And they will basically get used to fermenting at 64 degrees, something in that range, which is on the colder end for a lot of homebrewers. And then they'll throw something like the Fuller strain, which is Pub, into the mix. And that is a notorious sleeper. That Pub strain will flock out very, very early. And so if you're throwing that into a big beer under a relatively cold temperature, you haven't done what that yeast needs to perform consistently. Obviously, if it falls asleep, kicking it back up to finish off your beer is going to change the flavor versus just letting the yeast ferment your entire beer up front.
Yeah. And then also, I like to tell everybody that comes in the shop too, especially on vigorous fermenters, things like your Chico strain, your Flagship, whatever, you got to expect a free rise in your fermenter. It's going to be a little bit difficult to control that, but just knowing that it's there, I usually expect on a vigorous fermentation somewhere in the range of about 3 degrees Fahrenheit of a temperature free rise. So say you want to hit 68 degrees during your fermentation, I'll usually set my ambient temperature for about 65. And then I expect it as it warms up by day two or three to hit that 68 degree mark.
Yep, and this scales with the size of your fermentation, basically.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people that, you know, they scale up, they don't necessarily expect this, but if you're going from a 5-gallon to a 5-barrel system, that free rise, especially in a vigorous fermentation, can go from 1 to 2 degrees to 10 to 15 degrees. We have come in on days that we were planning on a vigorous fermentation with things like Quike strain, with things like a Saison strain, and the fermenter has been at 85 degrees the next day. Which is appropriate for those styles, so we didn't really worry about controlling that temperature, but it's something that you got to learn to expect.
And that's why glycol is necessary on a big system, too.
That's why you need it. Another thing that a lot of people, I'm surprised, have seen some commercial brewers in the area skip, and one of the first most important things you need to get when you're a commercial brewery is that oxygenation in line.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm surprised some people skip that.
Yeah, unless somehow you have like a stone at the very bottom of your cone, which would be awkward in a tank. But
that would be. Real quick, we got one. Any tips on doing a starter clean? Yes, I like to do it in borosilicate glass, that Pyrex basically. And then I like to basically pour the boiled wort into that very, very hot, seal it up into a either a breathable thing that's very small.
On that note, keep talking.
You know, even just aluminum foil would be good, and then I like to cool it down in the same vessel. That way I'm killing things with heat. Obviously, the vessel itself needs to be clean at that point, but I'm killing it with heat at that point, and that makes it so that I'm much more confident that things are going to be sanitized.
And we just started carrying product in the shop this winter, which are these little foam stoppers, which are awesome for your Erlenmeyer flask. These guys, we soak them in star sand and just pop them in the top. They'll actually allow that to breathe, but still keep all the nasty beasties out.
So that's what we use to do a clean starter. Let's go backwards in methods from the yeast health, and let's go to just consistency in your boil time and chilling time. So that we're just going to kind of work backwards from the pitch. So consistency in chilling time is, I think, one of the biggest spots for variables that I see a lot of homebrewers get, especially when doing something like an IPA.
Yeah, any of the New World IPAs that we're throwing late editions in, even, you know, West Coast, Northwest, you name it, anything that's going to have a Whirlpool edition hop, You're depending on how fast you chill your batch of beer down, you're going to get more or less utilization from those hops. So you're going to get more bitterness or less bitterness or more flavor or less flavor, depending on how long that sits hot, especially up above that kind of 120, 140 degree range.
Mm-hmm. This is something that definitely scales in bigger systems. A lot of bigger systems, even if they can recirculate back into the boil kettle, they still have to recirculate through a heat exchanger, a counterflow heat exchanger, meaning the wort goes out of the boil kettle, cools down in a heat exchanger, and then goes back into the boil kettle. But what you got to realize is for a good chunk of time, that means the stuff that's in the boil kettle is still very, very hot. And so if you added a 0 minute addition before that starts to actually chill down, you basically give it at a 5 minute addition, and that's something you got to take into account. So The longer it takes you to chill, basically the more you've got to move those hopping additions towards the end of your boil.
Yeah, I definitely think in some ways having just a regular immersion chiller on small batches almost makes that a little more consistent, a little easier for that nice, like, easy, steady drop in temperature versus a counterflow. With that said, when I'm running a counterflow on small 5 or 10 gallon batches, what I'll usually do is just barely crack my water on it so that I'm not running that thing full bore, so that it's only dropping the temperature down to, you know, instead of down to 60 degrees, maybe down to 120 degrees before it recirculates that back in, so I can get that nice steady drop over the course of 15 minutes or so.
And we account for that when we're talking about our hopping too. So a lot of our hopping does go in the last, you know, 10 minutes of the boil, or even just all in the whirlpool, depending on the style of IPA that we're doing. But yeah, I completely agree. A counter or an immersion chiller for a lot of 5 gallon homebrewers is a much easier way to just make sure it cools consistently. But you still got to focus on the time that it takes to cool. So like in the winter, when you have really cold groundwater,
just about to mention that,
it's probably going to chill in 10 minutes or so. Whereas in the summer, if you got really hot groundwater, it might take a half hour to an hour to chill. You will not make the same IPA in that time frame. So just things to consider when it comes to consistency and chilling.
I think that's something that you definitely want to consider when you're talking about hop utilizations for your IPA. So pay attention to that. Pay attention to how you're adding your hops. What that might mean is that in the wintertime, you're doing a flame out addition. In the summertime, you might want to drop that down to, you know, 170 degrees or so before you pop those hops in if you're trying to get a similar impact.
Yeah, and we did just have somebody say give a range on the whirlpool, more bitterness versus less aroma. If you're really going for that aroma punch and you want to kind of eliminate that bitterness, I always shoot for below 180. And what I like to do at that point is I'll kill my immersion chiller on a small batch, and then I'll actually add that hop addition, give it a good stir, and then I'll pop a lid on. So I'll actually try to do the rest of it as closed as possible. If you could do that, you know, in a perfectly sealed vessel, that'd be even better. But I like to make sure that those hops get time to soak in all the juicy goodness. But at that range, you'll get a lot less bitterness. The only thing to also consider that is when you're throwing really big whirlpool additions in, you want to make sure you have some way to get out the plant matter. Fermenting on plant matter sometimes can give you a little bit of extra bitterness.
Yeah, ultimately for bitterness, as soon as you get below like 200, really is all you need to do. Your bitterness utilization drops quite a bit. You're really not pulling much, anywhere below, I'd say 190 to be on the safe side. But as for like those aromatics, we've tried to find research, and there's really not a lot of research, at least not that people are willing to share, because we've heard 180, 170, 140 even on the low end to quote unquote pull different types of oils. But you know, there's not really a lot of like good scientific data out there on that as of today.
So. It's still a heavily researched topic, but what I've kind of gone with is, I've done, 180 to 170 is kind of that range that I've seemed to get a lot of the tropical fruit notes. Mm-hmm. And then down in that 140 degree range is when I've gotten some more bright citrus notes, without the bitterness that you get from like a early boil, like a grapefruit citrusness.
Yep. And then depending on how fast your system can kind of drop things down from those ranges, typically we'll recommend doing kind of a hop stand, anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes. If it's going to take you a little bit longer, maybe even reduce that down to like 5 minutes, just so that you don't end up letting those hops sit in there hot for, you know, 30 or 35 minutes. That's generally the rule of thumb that we follow.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of people make that mistake where they start to they do a hop stand and they're like, yeah, I wanted to really get that, so I soaked it for an hour at 180 degrees. And I'm like, well, you probably pulled something you weren't looking for. Length of time below 180 for max aromas. Same kind of thing. That's kind of what we just touched on. Is that 15 to 20 minutes? That popped up just at the right time, because that's probably going to show up in your guys' faces in like a minute, because we seem to be on a delay. Let's go to so let's go backwards and work on that boil and kind of consistency and what you're aiming for with the boil.
For boil, I usually just shoot for a nice, easy rolling boil. It doesn't have to be climbing out of the pot, but also you definitely want it more than the simmer. Most people at home are going to be using propane burners, and a trick that I always like to share with people is once you hit that nice rolling boil that you're happy with, I actually just put a little Sharpie mark on my regulator to my propane tank, and that way for my next batch, I can turn it right back to that same Sharpie mark, and I should get a fairly consistent boil, at least a boil off as a result.
Until your propane tank starts to die, and then it starts, you know, then you, there's all sorts of
most
stuff.
Most people aren't using like super crazy ones like we are, though.
That's true. there's the intensity of the boil, and there's been kind of some mixed research on whether or not that has a huge effect, but we like to say that it definitely, at least if nothing else, affects your evaporation rate, so you can start to dial in what final volume you're going to get and the level of concentration you're going to get. Then there's also the time of the boil, and again, if you're going to do a short boil, that's closer to I don't know, what do you consider that? You're basically breaking out less proteins with a short boil. The 60 versus 90 minute addition, I'm pretty, or 90 minute boil, I'm pretty much just going for if I want that extra stability, I want that extra Maillard. We do long boils a lot. And the only thing that I can say consistency that helps with is that it does form certain compounds that actually makes your beer more shelf stable. And so if you're going to be aging your beer at all, a long boil is really good.
Darkens the living daylights out of your beer too if you do it for 4 hours.
Yeah, we found that one out. We were going for it on purpose.
If you're not using propane, if you're using electric, that's actually probably ideal for consistency because you're going to get the same amount of power no matter what.
So yeah, especially if you've got that Anvil Foundry and you can dial in the percentage.
That's true.
Again, so while we're in the boil, we got to talk about hopping and a consistency with hopping. That can be very, people can be surprised by how much that can vary when you bag your hops, which I actually personally like to do. The biggest thing with bagging your hops is you have to make sure that you're using a very, very oversized bag and making sure that you're getting, you know, that full roll through the bag. Whereas if you don't bag your hops, you generally, with IPAs specifically, have to do something to make sure that you're reducing that down the road.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is if you're not letting your hops circulate around in there, because when you add them in just freehand, they're going to be rolling around in that boil. So your surface area, that contact area that you can kind of extract as much flavor, as much character as possible from those guys, is really going to be maxed out where if you bag them or if you have a hop spider, which I've used in the past, or we've used the little mesh guys as well, you're going to get a drop of utilization. And I'm not trying to say that's a bad thing, but it is something to consider, especially for your bitterness. I mean, I've literally had to drop my hop utilization down to like 50 to 60% if I have a big screen or a bag in there, just because you're extracting that much less bitterness from a boil addition.
And one thing that we're going to be playing with pretty soon is going to be basically small scale ways to do things that people on the big scale do to really maximize that hop flavor that you get. Because there are things that commercial brewers that are brewing on really high-tech systems have advantages that they can do that you really have to finagle your way through if you want to try to achieve the same fantastic IPA flavor on the small scale. Things like doing a hop back, especially a pressurized hop back if you can. Things like, you know, inline filtration transfers. They're basically filters that'll put hops at the very beginning of the filter, run the wort through hot, and then filter it out before it goes into the heat exchanger. There's a lot of techniques that commercial brewers can use that we just don't have access to on the small scale. So we're going to try to figure out how to fake those and let you know.
So somebody was just asking too about first wort hopping and what our thoughts are on that. And, you know, I think I really haven't played with it much other than I do like to throw in just a little bit to help with the hop break.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed if you throw in just a small handful of hops when you're coming up to a boil, it'll kind of make that hop break be a little more gradual just because it has something to sort of cause that the boil to cling on to. What am I? Nucleation. There we go.
Proteins like to glom onto the hop material, basically, and so it will help with a hop break. That said, if you're not paying attention, it will also immediately fire up a boil over. So, you know, you got to be.
Don't do it when you're already out of hop break.
Yeah.
It's probably not the best idea.
But yeah, first wort hopping, like as you're transferring into the kettle or something like that. I personally don't really use it, but yeah. I don't see a lot of flavor benefits. I think I've done some experiments with first wort versus just doing a 60-minute addition or a 90-minute addition, and
I think that also just really comes down to our style of brewing here, though, too. I mean, so we like to load up hops so much on the back end. You know, we've really that circa 2000 style of brewing, we have more or less left in the past. For instance, we actually have a really, really nice dry IRA that we did almost 2 weeks ago now. And this thing it's a bitter beer, and yet I don't think, what was our bittering addition? Was a 5-minute addition on it? You know what I mean? It's one of those things.
No, that one we used a hop oil on.
Oh, did we use hop oil?
Yeah, we used hop oil.
But it still wasn't very, very,
I think it was like a 30-minute addition, but.
But yeah, so we don't really, we're not going for a huge bitter punch. Most of the beers we do really are not that bitter, even our IPAs. And I think that just goes to show what people like these days.
And generally, we just get whatever bitterness we want from a very small percentage of a very high alpha hop. That's, you know, unless we're doing something like an ESB or a classic English style beer, which kind of relies on that extra hop plant.
Yeah, penis. Those would be kind of the only exception, I guess.
But yeah, for most beers that we're trying to do, we do something like Warrior or something like even a cryo hop if we got some extra, something super high alpha or hop oils that we'll throw in early on. And then from there, actually Short Circuit Brewers mentioned that he doesn't really see any mid-range additions. We don't do a ton of mid-range additions either. We kind of throw them all in on the back end and try to figure out ways to infuse them with different whirlpool stands, different infusion techniques towards the end. So,
yeah.
And somebody did mention seasonal variability in boil off. That's actually a really fun science, basically. What kind of vectors you're creating with different altitudes and different levels of humidity, basically. So
yeah, that does happen. I don't think it's that much, though. I mean, that might be 5%.
Well, not for us, but if you go from like very, very bone dry to very, very humid, it'll for sure make a difference.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to systems, because we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but systems basically are something that I see a lot of professional brewers struggle with when they get a new system, because they haven't played around with having to rework what they do almost every single batch like we do.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what is the best method for breaking in a system. I would just say find a good online calculator, honestly, for a brand new system that'll help you calculate some water and some grain losses and hop losses and all that other good stuff. Brew a batch with it and just do a kind of random batch that doesn't really matter if you're off one way or another. Say do like a pale ale or a hoppy blonde ale, something like that, and then just track those numbers religiously throughout the brew day, and then whatever you end up with at the end, use that to adjust all those calculations with going into your next brew.
So I think you kind of skipped ahead a little bit and telling people what you know, what they're actually looking for with calculations and stuff like that. So a part of like knowing a new system is knowing what's going to give you different flavors, and that comes with experience. And so things like different boil off rates, different shapes that create, you know, let your hops infuse at different times. If you've got different flavors, knowing how to work backwards from those. So calculators in terms of things like boil off rates can help you understand how your new system's going to work. And so a lot of that just comes down to experience and working backwards from any off flavors that you get. A steam condenser does give you, I would say, the best repeatable results. There are a lot of good commercial systems that do basically mimic steam jacketed systems, but they do that with basically using an air pocket. So indirect fire is what it's called. They've got the heat source over here, and then they've got a jacket where air can flow through on the side of the kettle over here. And that can create some pretty good consistency too. But I do prefer steam systems. On the commercial scale, they're just very expensive to get into, and usually involve some relicensing with the city that isn't really fun to do.
Yeah, so you don't blow yourself up.
Yeah, but in general, when it comes to new systems, I would say, like Logan said, make a beer and then work backwards from the difference in flavors that you get.
Yeah, and I guess I'm mostly referring to, when I talk about that too, I'm mostly referring to final volume size and efficiencies for all grain beers.
Mm-hmm.
For extract beers, it's pretty easy, other than maybe, I guess, what kind of utilization you're getting from your hops, because extract beers, the beauty of those is you can just top off with water up to whatever your final volume is. But when you're brewing all grain, it's definitely probably one of the most difficult things, especially on a new system, is trying to get that, you know, say you're going for a 5-gallon batch into a keg, is trying to get that perfect, you know, 5.2 to maybe 5.4 gallons into a fermenter.
On the mashing side, it can actually make a huge difference too, not knowing, for example, heat loss, which that's something that you can look into for, you know, testing out your new system basically. But when you strike in, knowing how much heat you plan on losing, also if you end up doing any sort of step mash or, you know, some sort of multi-steps.
And again, that's probably one of those things where if it was my first go on a new system, I would try to just shoot for the middle.
Most complicated beer possible and just see what happens.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, no, shoot for the middle, you know, shoot for about 151 degrees maybe or so, something like that. And then if you're 155 or 145, I would just let it ride. And again, that's why you just do a nice kind of like a pale ale or something that is just going to kind of work no matter what.
Yeah. Let's go on to ingredients. Ingredients is something we've kind of been going over with our malt series. And there are a wide range of ingredients. And so,
yeah, so that's going to be probably the last thing that you're going down the list troubleshooting on. But it can happen because a lot of people will bring in a beer recipe and they'll be like, I made this last summer and it was amazing, so I want to make it again this summer. And you're like, yeah, but that hop tastes like crap this summer.
Seasonal variability in hops is a huge thing. We get different hops year to year. And we'll notice big differences. Another thing to think about is just the freshness of your hops. Sometimes, you know, we've seen it happen where we've actually been shipped in hops that are 2 years old and we'll immediately go like, no, we can't take this. Give it, you know, send it back. Cause we'd rather pay more for a hop that we know is going to be fresh and taste good. So seasonal variability ingredients, when you're looking at recipes, that's a huge factor. The other factor is just, you know, maybe you got an ingredient from a different brew shop, or from a different source and they carry a different base malt, for example.
Yeah, it could be, yeah, base malts are going to have obviously a huge, huge difference on the beer, depending on even, you know, what manufacturer base malt that you got. Also any of your specialty malts, if you're not going to carry those same brands. Doing all these side-by-sides, we're finding out that these specialty malts, they might have the same friggin' name on them, and yet they're going to all have totally different flavors, like our brown malts.
That's right. So we haven't published the brown malt one yet.
I don't think we have, actually.
Monday.
Yeah.
Stay tuned Monday. We'll publish a side-by-side on brown malts, but you might have already seen our chocolate malts one.
Yeah. The brown malt blew my mind, though.
It was crazy different.
Crazy difference.
But you can look at things like how the malt was made, and then things like just the SRM can give you some ideas. Let's move on to something a little bit more fun.
What do we get?
Let's talk about let's just brainstorm some spring seasonal styles.
Spring seasonal styles.
Get some water. Yeah, like, you got this.
Like our milkshakes.
No, like browns.
Oh, browns. Want to talk about browns?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Spring seasonal styles.
Okay, so browns are going to vary a lot, though. That's the beauty of them. You can go really light for the spring styles, what I would go with. Right now, we have a actual brown porter on tap, which is sort of a hybrid between a brown
and a porter. Yeah. What I think of when I think of spring is relatively neutral beers that for some reason you take and you're like, let's make this hoppier, or let's dry hop it, or do something fun with it like that. So something like a nice neutral brown base, and then you take it and you throw a little bit of extra bitterness at it. Or in our case, we just use a malt that's a little bit more bitter and aggressive, which worked out really, really nicely. Creates a really fun spring flavor.
Hoppy wheat beers. American wheat and dry hop the living daylights out of it. It actually works really well.
Absolutely. Even a little bit of a Bavarian style wheat with that banana clove flavor, and then putting some dry hops on that, some nice pleasant things.
Little session red, American red, that is.
Yeah. So when I think of spring, I think of basically, like I said, more neutral beers that you just kind of take and either hop or you add some sort of fruits to and make some fun flavors.
That's about all I have to say on that. I don't know where you're going with it.
I don't know. That's all. I was just trying to brainstorm. We didn't come up with an extensive list, and the next topic that we have is another kind of long, boring-ish kind of topic, and so I figured let's go with something fun. If you guys got some Q&As, let's go on to that, and then we'll close out with some Q&A, and then we got to open up the store, so we can't do too much longer.
Bam.
Let's see what all we've got.
See one question about biotransformation hopping and then timing for dry hops in general. That's actually a really good question. So the biotransformation hop is all going to depend on your fermentation. Typically, that's going to be done right at high krausen, and that's sort of a tricky subject with the homebrewer crowd, because typically if you're just going to add a bunch of dry hops of a regular pelletized hop in there, right, you're going to let them sit in the during the fermentation for about 2 to 3 days. And then what you're actually going to do is open up your dump valve and get those suckers out of there, because you don't want them sitting in there for another week or so. Unfortunately, on a homebrew side of thing, most people don't have the ability to use really, really nice, fancy stainless conicals. So the workaround is going to be the lupulin or the cryo hops, the hop hash, right? Things that have been had the plant matter sort of taken out of them. So that's really the best way to do a biotransformation hop, I think, on the homebrew scale, if you don't have a way to get those hops out of the beer.
What I've always done is I've always made it so that you can time it out so that it still has some fermentation when you go into a keg, and then I just let it finish out in the keg. Some of the hops will already be done. Hopefully when you get it into the keg, you're still purging it, but it's got a little bit of fermentation to help clean up any oxygen pickup that you got into the keg. Yeah. It's kind of the closest you can get to a complete closed transfer system. But biotransformation, when I was doing it, I've actually done some hazies in an open vessel, actually.
Yeah.
And what I did is, as soon as I hit high krausen, I threw the hops in. And then as soon as that krausen started to drop, I just went straight into, in our case, a bright tank. But, sometimes for you, that means going into a keg. Yeah. The downside to that is that you're going to get a lot of gunk in your keg. But a keg to keg transfer is something that you can do, where you can just put a little liquid to liquid side jumper in your keg and get that beer into a clean vessel that is completely purged.
Pull
with
it
CO2.
Off of that hop material. Yeah.
Yeah.
As for a regular dry hop addition, usually I kind of do the, what is it, the Jimmy Kimmick or whatever his name is from the Alchemist Brewing. He does, I believe it's a 3 day dry hop. It might be a 4 day dry hop. And that's kind of the traditional West Coast dry hop, even though they're on the East Coast. That seems to get you the max utilization out of those hops. You're going to get the most flavor without sort of getting into that realm of starting to pull some of the chlorophyll material from them. With that said, I have also experimented and tried other beers that some homebrewers have done where they do like 24-hour dry hops, and those seem to have a lot more aromatics intact, but also those same aromatics tend to like literally just disappear from the keg a week afterwards. So it's just kind of that where do you want to sit there? You know, do you want to get those really highly volatile aromatics, or do you want to have a little more stable product in the end?
This does kind of go into basically the home brewing versus commercial brewing techniques that we can kind of try to fake. And for that kind of same effect, people used to dry hop for 5 to 7 days. That used to be the thing, or even 10 days. And that does start to risk getting some green material. But even if you don't get that plant material, from what I understand, you can actually get some softer, fruitier characteristics off the hops with those kind of, even in the old West Coast style dry hops. But that, 3 day dry hop, it does give you that nice bright material, or that nice bright, all the pungents that you want off your hops without leaving too much of the...
Seems to be like at the peak of that sort of curve of like...
Yeah.
Getting there, and then getting not.
But whether or not you can do a shorter one, you really got to think about things like, is there a way to agitate so you can get that hop diffusion a little bit faster?
Are they going to settle out for you? Are you going to have a bunch of hops in suspension? Yeah.
What people on the commercial scale are able to do is actually close transfer through a series of filters, basically. So they're forcing that maximum contact on all these hops, but then they're also getting the beer off the green material.
Yeah.
So ways to try to trick that system, that commercial breweries have that advantage and we don't have that advantage, kind of a fun way to think about, basically.
Yeah.
So maximize your contact, reduce your contact time, and then you'll get great beer. Let's go on to someone asked, Rye IPA is one of my favorite spring beers. We last vid talked about step mashing. Would I suggest a step mash on a Rye IPA? Absolutely. I would do an acid rest, or I'd at least do some sort of an acid infusion. The reason being, I like my Rye IPA is kind of more aggressive. And so if you do too much rye, especially something like flaked rye, which has got a really fantastic rye flavor, you're going to end up with a thicker beer. And I like my IPAs to be nice and thin. So combining a step mash with all that rye and getting a nice thin beer with all the same rye flavor, that's why I would do a step mash for a rye IPA.
Yeah. Not necessarily mashing too, but please use some rice hulls on that guy as well. Otherwise you're going to hate yourself.
Yeah. Especially if you do something like ridiculous, I don't know, like do 40% rye or something like that.
And then do an IPL with it? Yeah.
Silly.
Those guys, I don't know who does that.
How long after fermentation is finished do you think you should keg? Depends on my system. If I can completely close transfer, I don't care. I just do whenever I can, basically. Yeah. I'll wait for it to clear up as long as I know that the system is perfectly clear. If I'm fermenting in a carboy or a bucket or something like that, I'll actually try to go right when fermentation's about to finish, just knowing that it's going to finish up in the keg, and then I'll let it sit in the keg. I'll usually tap that same keg on the homebrew scale, but if I don't, and I want to get a nice clear beer, or I'm going to shake it up a lot, then I can do that closed system transfer.
It'll help to another scrub keg. Out any oxygen by doing it that way too. That's kind of the whole premise of that. But yeah, ultimately it depends on the beer. Use your mouth, actually. Mouth? Tongue?
No, use your mouth. Aww.
Excuse me. Bottom line is if you see your airlock stop bubbling, give it a taste. If the beer tastes good to you, probably ready to keg. If it tastes like it's a little bit green, give it another few days at a nice room temperature, and then let it clean itself up. So
using green apples towards the end of a beer to make it hazy for a hazy / milkshake. No, haven't used that. I could see that.
It's an odd one.
Yeah. I can see that being a thing with like bananas or something too. If you're adding fruit in general, honestly, will kind of add some haze to it. We did that with a grapefruit beer pretty recently, and that grapefruit juice kind of just hazed it up.
Generally, I mean, just the nature of a hazy is that you're just it has a lot to do with just the sheer amount of adjuncts and then the biotransformation. It's not the point is not to make the beer hazy. The haze is a byproduct of how you make the beer.
And making some really great beer.
Yeah.
Also, don't pump the wort. They push it with CO2. Mosaic smells like kind of.
Do you think the clear up thing is necessary?
That also depends on the beer.
Yeah, it's.
If I'm
in the yeast strain mostly.
Well, if I'm doing I'm doing like an English style, brown ale, I'll actually probably appreciate it more if it ends up being bright and clear.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, yeah, it's homebrew. It doesn't have to be clear. But if you end up with a milky beer, sometimes that's also indicative of a. Like impatience or even, oxygen pickup late in fermentation sometimes can, leave some haze that doesn't like to drop out.
Yeah. And I think it depends on really, to me, it depends on whether or not that haze is from yeast in suspension or whether it's from the proteins that are in suspension. Right.
Yeah.
Because if it's a protein haze, a lot of times, like if you blindfold your beer and find one and don't find the other, you're probably not going to notice a difference. But if it's from yeast, one that specifically comes to mind is actually the classic German ale strain that really likes to stay flowery for us, stay in suspension. I noticed that, after maybe a week or two, that yeast is, you still taste it. It has that kind of thick, bready feel. Whereas once you get it cold crashed for a few weeks and that yeast all drops out, that beer tends to taste a lot cleaner.
Yeah.
So all just depends on, a lot of factors going into that.
All right. I think we're pretty close. Some more people have commented on the green apple adding pectins to create haze. I'll have to try it. I think it could be a fun thing to do. But it says it doesn't add flavor. I would want the flavor. Anytime I'm adding fruit to beer, I'm aiming for that flavor. I'm not like Logan said, I'm not aiming for the aesthetic or necessarily the haziness. We can get that with just practices. We had nearly 40% oats between flaked oats and malted oats to a lot of our hazies, and that gives us a nice, almost oily kind of haze, which I think is what you're going for, especially if you want that kind of glass of orange juice look. But yeah, it sounds like green apple could be fun too.
So GJ, it says that their mosaic is smelling a little bit off from their Citra and Chinook, and Mosaic, yeah, it's possible that's bad, but Mosaic naturally will kind of have a really, really unique aromatic to it. Typically, at least for some of the new hops that we have, it should be pretty herbal. It should almost be, a little bit like Chinook, but almost like kind of like an East Kent Golding characteristic to it. Really, really a lot of that black tea character.
Yeah, I usually get like currant, and then it does have like big tropical fruit, but it's got that same like a little bit of Simcoe-y kind of pininess, like that aggression, that catty aggression that it can have.
Yeah,
a little bit. It's a dynamic hop, but if it smells off, it depends on how it's smelling off.
Yeah,
if it's starting to smell cheesy, like
bad feet.
Yeah, Parmesan is how I describe it. But if it starts to smell like Parmesan, that's one of the ways that you know that it's old / oxidized.
Yeah.
And that's also a way you can get unwanted bitterness, because there's some bittering compounds in there that are not the clean alpha acid bitterness. They're more of an aggressive, like, you know, make you want to scrape your tongue off kind of bitterness.
Yeah. And also, it's, if it does have a smell, I mean, other than just like a couple hop varieties, if it smells like what I like to call just kind of like a rotten wood smell, that's just probably stale hops at that point. And you can usually tell they'll kind of have this like pale oxide layer on them. And, yeah, so generally those can still be used for bittering, but probably not the best practice on like a whirlpool or a dry hop at that point.
Yeah. Any other questions? I'm scrolling up to see if there's any more. But if not, we'll probably wrap it up pretty soon, since we got to open up the shop in a few minutes. Sure way to tell the hop.
Yeah, stuff. Please don't use flour in your hazy IPAs.
Yeah. No cheating. Just use lots of oats.
Oats and hops. Add more hops. You'll get haze. Promise you.
Well, speaking of haze, thanks for watching our Purple Haze stream.
Yeah.
We'll try to figure that out for next time. This is week 2 on our live stream, and so we're still very much learning. A lot of this equipment is brand new to us too.
Hopefully our audio sounds better this time at least.
Yeah, how's the audio? Give us a little rating on that if it's sounding a lot better. Yep. Too expensive, use your nose. Cold crash in Nipah and Hefeweizen. We cold crash every beer.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens when you put it in a keg. All right. Well, till next time. Bam. I got my little baggie, you know, because
Someone's doing medicine. Someone asked, why do we plan on doing THC-infused beer? If it becomes legal in Washington, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, totally. We'll jump on it.
Chiefs or 49ers? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's today.
We're totally on top of it. I'm going to go Chiefs, actually. I've enjoyed watching the 49ers play more this year, but since one of our good fellow brewers in town is a diehard Chiefs fan, I think we got to go Chiefs.
Sure. All right. See you, everybody.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you watching, and we'll see you next week. Comment some things on our Instagram if you've got ideas of what you want us to talk about, and we can come more prepared. Thanks.
Yeah. Bye.
Cheers.